This AMP conference that we're doing at Eastside Church, by the way, it's a church that took over the Boeing facility in Anaheim, so it's got lots of room. And we're preaching 10 speakers, literally from all across the country, and we told each one of them 30 minutes. So they're going to be really crisp talks. And rather than focusing on apologetics content, it's more how to do apologetics to have evangelistic fruit. Basically, because we figure you know where to go to get the tools. Each speaker will actually tell you, these are some tools, but basically here's how to use the tools. Because what we noticed in apologetics is that often people will grab the tools, but they use them in the wrong way and wind up not having as effective results as they otherwise would. So four of us will be speaking Friday night, and six will be speaking Saturday morning and a Saturday afternoon. And I've actually got a little video clip here I can play for you. Let me see if I can get this up and running. Here we go. And
I know it's hard to believe, but we weren't always so quiet. There was a time when progressive thinking, that was what marked us. The Renaissance, that was catalyzed by Christians. And later Isaac Newton, John Locke, and Blaise Pascal, they were Christians who made incredible contributions to human thinking. But somewhere along the way, people who followed Jesus lost their seat at the table. Today, it seems as if you follow Jesus, your voice isn't even heard in the conversation. That's why we've assembled the greatest minds we could find to share the evidence they found. Evidence that has the power to do away with the doubt that keeps us silent. So we can be beacons of light in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, and in all the places in between. So come and experience what it's like to have the confidence to break the silence, to amplify your voice in any context, and change a lost and waiting world.
Okay, you can still register. You can register at the door as well, but I think we have to charge $20 extra because we're providing a great lunch, and it's always nice to know how many people are coming. And so for those who register at the door, we actually have to send people out to get extra food. So that's why it's a little bit extra at the door. But if you register now, I think it's like $50 for the entire thing, so, and that includes the meal. Yes.
Will this be a resource afterwards, since this is a recent production that should be available, DVD or audio or something?
It'll be, yeah, everything's being recorded. It'll be available afterwards. And what we're actually doing with each of the 10 speakers is kind of target a particular people group. So like Abdu Murray, for example, he's an Islamic apologist who became a Christian. And so he's going to be focusing how to use apologetics to reach out to Muslims. And people will be focusing on you. So each of us is kind of picking a different target group and basically saying these are the resources that you can use. Hey, a question. How many of you have seen this hubbub on the web about how physicists in Canada and Egypt have disproven the Big Bang and disproven the beginning of the universe? Yeah. Yeah, I looked at it and said, you know, surely this isn't being taken seriously. But hey, they've been getting TV interviews. Virtually every newspaper in the world has picked it up, and the paper is not yet even published. So it kind of reminds me of this Bicep 2 thing where the people behind the research jumped the gun and made a public announcement, got a big splash, and then later had to withdraw the result. And Bicep 2 was an attempt to find gravity waves near the beginning of the universe. And I think eventually they're going to do it. But they jumped the gun and published it before they really had sufficient data to make their claim. And what I noticed in the reviews, by the way, here are just some of the titles. Quantum equations suggest the Big Bang never occurred. The universe has no beginning. And then that was on the web. And Big Bang didn't happen. New theory suggests universe has no beginning and no end. That was from a British newspaper, Daily Mail. Did the Big Bang ever happen? Quantum modeling predicts universes no beginning, and it could even explain dark energy. So, and the claim was that this paper was published in Physics Letters B, and that kind of gave me a tip off because I'm familiar with that journal. Yes.
Yeah, this thing is a sign of desperation.
Well, I think you're going to get a lot of public attention if you say the Big Bang never happened, the universe has no beginning. Regardless of the foundation of your claim, it's going to get a lot of play. I've seen over 15 web articles on this. There's been TV interviews. It's been on national television. It's even caught the attention of our Congress. So for that reason, I thought I needed to respond to this. And hey, I actually found the paper. Not the one that's going to be published in Physics Letters B. It's not published yet. And there's even some doubt about whether it will be published. But this is the preprint. I was able to dig up the preprint. And so this is what's been submitted to Physics Letters B. But yeah, before I take any questions, a word about Physics Letters B. It's a specialty physics journal that publishes theoretical models on a wide variety of topics of interest to physicists. And they permit a lot of latitude. So as I read that journal, it's filled with speculative models of the universe, where they basically allow the physicists to let their imaginations run wild and come up with some mathematics. And it doesn't matter if it pertains to physical reality. If a mathematical model is interesting, it gets published within reason. They do kind of, you know, if it's really way out there, they will say no. But for example, this is the journal where people will speculate, well, what about these brain models? Now, we're not talking B-R-A-I-N, it's B-R-A-N-E, which is this idea that there are extra dimensions of space, not the little ones, but the big ones, that hypothetically accompany our four space-time dimensions, and they speculate about different universes interacting with one another. And, you know, if it's not testable or falsifiable, it doesn't matter, they'll get it published anyway. So I think that's why these people submitted it to Physics Letter B. It kind of fits their venue. So that's a disclaimer right there. But go ahead.
Person in perhaps the same vein or related vein, I personally asked Sean Carroll a question about why there's something instead of nothing. He said that's a bad question. And I couldn't believe my ears. And I later learned that Richard Dawkins said that's a silly question to a similar question.
Well, it's a good question. Why is there something instead of nothing? It's the ultimate question we all have to answer. So, anyway, the paper, this is the preprint, and even if you just read the first sentence, it kind of gives you a tip off what's happening. By the way, it was published by an Egyptian physicist and a physicist at the University of Alberta in Lethbridge. If you haven't heard of Lethbridge, it's a small prairie town in the southeast part of the province of Alberta. The physicists there come from India. And they have kind of a Hindu worldview that they're bringing to physics. And basically this paper is borrowing from the physics of David Bohm. How many of you ever heard of David Bohm? Okay, a few of you. David Bohm is a quantum physicist who wrote papers back in the 50s and 60s and 70s as well. But he's kind of labeled as the father of a New Age philosophy. And the New Age philosophers lean heavily on David Bohm's work to claim that there's an alternate reality. And what David Bohm did is basically come up with new laws of quantum mechanics. And this paper is based on that. But I'll just read from the very first line of the abstract. It says, "We replace classical geodesics with quantum Bohmian trajectories." Now, that probably doesn't mean a lot to you. Okay. You say, what on earth is a geodesic? That's the physics term for the shortest distance between two points. But it could be the shortest distance between two points on a curved surface. So, for example, the shortest distance between Los Angeles and Paris actually is a curve that takes you over the southern part of Greenland. That is the shortest distance on curved space. So that's what a geodesic is. And when cosmologists build their models of the universe, it's built on these geodesics. Well, what these two physicists did, their names are Ahmed Farag Ali and Sarya Das. So I'm guessing you've got a Muslim from Egypt and a Hindu from India that are working together on this. What they're doing is saying, we're not going to use geodesics like cosmologists normally do. We're going to replace those geodesics with these David Bohm trajectories, these quantum trajectories. But by definition, these quantum trajectories do not allow for singularities. So here they claim in their paper, where you come up with a new model of the universe that shows the universe has no beginning. But they begin with a set of quantum physics laws that, by definition, don't even permit beginnings, don't permit singularities. Let me give you the, here it is. Classical geodesics, which is how standard cosmology is done, eventually cross one another as you trace the universe back in time. And the points where they converge are the singularities. But Bohmian trajectories never cross each other. And so singularities never occur. So right in the first sentence of the paper, we know they're invoking circular reasoning. They're saying we're going to replace the standard geodesics of cosmology with these Bohmian trajectories, but the Bohmian trajectories, by definition, don't permit the existence of singularities. Three papers of mathematics, the conclusion of the paper is the universe has no singularity. Well, the opening assumption guarantees the result that they publish. This may explain why I've not yet seen the paper in Physics Letters B. Chances are the reviewers may have spotted this circular reasoning and said, you know, we're not publishing this. However, it's all over the internet, and I've had to spend literally hours on my Facebook page addressing the fears of Christians to say, hey, the core of our Christian belief looks like it's been disproven. What are we going to do? So I've been telling them, well, wait a minute. What's really going on here speculation about introducing these new laws of quantum mechanics. And there is zero experimental evidence to support the existence of these Bohmian trajectories. It's an idea that was proposed. And by the way, the idea was proposed in order to come up with a concept of an illusionary universe. So this is kind of the core of this New Age physics, yes.
Do you think they really believe it, or are they just playing with the math?
Well, I think they're wanting some alternative to the Christian implications of Big Bang cosmology. And so, yeah, they're basically playing with the math, and then they begin with these Bohmian trajectories. But as I said, by definition, it doesn't even allow for there to be a singularity. So, of course, the result they get is a universe with no beginning. Now, they never admit that that's what they're doing in the paper. I mean, the first time I read through the paper, I didn't spot it. I said, okay, a lot of arcane mathematics here, and it's a lot of speculation. And what I was looking for as an astronomer, I wonder if they make any predictions we can put to the test. As I went through the thing, I said, lots of mathematics, but no predictions. Now, they do kind of hint in the last sentence that they would like to further develop this model so they can get some predictable results. But they said that's for the future. But typically in science, if you don't have any predictable results, we really don't call it science. If there's no way to test it or to falsify it, then it really doesn't qualify as a scientific. However, Physics Letters B does permit the publication of papers for where there's no possibility to disprove it or to test it. So in that sense, this fits into that category. Yes.
That was my question. Like, what do we do as Christians if there isn't, because of the Bible? But then I'm reading the Quran, so they want us to believe in the seven universes out there. So we all have to believe in the Quran then. So it kind of fits that. But then even the evolutionists who want it to be true, what do they do with the Cambrian? So.
Well, the core of this paper is speculation about that early era of the universe for which we have no ability to investigate. Now, what's remarkable in astronomy is how close we can get to the beginning. we can get to within 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. But what these physicists are saying is we are ignorant about what happened between t equals zero and 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. And in that very tiny window of time, we're free to speculate. And so they speculate. Now, it's a classic case philosophically of denying what we know with what we don't know. And so that's one of the principles we're going to be bringing at this AMP conference, that you want to make your case from what we know, not from what we don't know. Keeping in mind that what we know is always increasing. And what we know is always increasing, and in that increasing knowledge, we're finding increasing evidence for the God of the Bible, that's a good thing for Christianity. But we shouldn't be disturbed about things we don't know. Now, we can test it by pushing the envelope of what we know to a greater extent and see what happens. That's legitimate apologetics. However, beware the atheist who says, I will not believe until we know everything. Well, we'll never know everything. And I know a lot of atheists who are in that position where they basically say, hey, until every door is closed, I'm going to hang on to what we don't know as a way to overturn what we do know. Yes.
But then those same atheists are married, probably, and they don't know every single solitary thing that ever happened.
I've often used that as an argument. If you're going to argue against the existence of God based on what we don't know, you could also argue against the existence of your wife based on what you don't know.
Exactly what's going to happen to any kids that they give birth to.
That's right. You're not going to know anything about them either. So, but I would argue general relativity is a lot easier to understand than teenage children. So. So, now, this whole paper is based on something called quantum potential theory. And given how much attention this paper has gotten, you're probably going to hear that term again and again. Now, I heard that term when I was much younger, and I thought it had died and gone away. Evidently, I think the mission of these two physicists is to revive Baum's idea of quantum potential theory. But quantum potential theory has its origin in Eastern mysticism. And you need to realize the New Age movement is basically a rebirth of Eastern mysticism. And this is what Baum writes. He believes that there is a deeper reality beneath the quantum level, a subquantum field he calls the quantum potential. So that's really what's going on. We got what's called standard quantum mechanics, but what David Baum is speculating is that there's a subquantum field for which we have no way of measuring or discovering that actually changes what happens at the quantum level. And what he's basically arguing about this quantum potential theory is that it alters the behavior of space, time, and causality. Now, back in 2008, the Skeptic Society here in Pasadena had an international conference on the existence of God. And you're probably aware I debated Victor Stenger at the end of that conference. But the five speakers that preceded the debate, every one of them was trying to use science to disprove the God of the Bible. And every one of them invoked a different definition of time and a different definition of causality. And the power of what's happened in Christian apologetics is that the evidence for the reliability and trustworthiness of the Bible and the God of the Bible has become so compelling that the leading atheist scientists have got nowhere else to go but to invoke a different definition of time or a different definition of causality. And so what they're claiming in this paper is that the universe has always existed and doesn't have a cause. But again, it's circular reasoning. They begin with a different definition of cause and effect, where effects, for example, can come, the principle is that effects always come after the causes. They're saying there's a possibility it could go the other way around. Well, if it could go the other way around, then that means that you, for example, are responsible for your own birth. The universe is responsible for its own existence. It doesn't need an external agent. And this is really what was behind this Bohmian philosophy, is that our powers of observation, our own existence, actually affects reality around us. Now, let me bring this back up again. So, in Baum's quantum potential theory, space and time, these are his words, space and time are no longer the dominant factors determining the relationships of dependence or independence of different elements. Rather, an entirely different sort of basic connection of elements is possible, from which our ordinary notions of space and time, along with those of separately existent material particles, are abstracted as forms derived from the deeper order. You all understood that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. He's using physics terminology to basically say our notions of space and time are wrong. Space and time are not what we think they are. And causality is not what we think we are. And again, this paper basically takes advantage of these different definitions of space and time and a causality to argue that God did not create the universe. It's always existed. And the Christians have got it wrong. Now, where they do try to come up with some observable, one of the authors, Sarya Das, he's the one from the University of Alberta, Lethbridge, he speculates at the end of the paper, the universe is filled with a quantum fluid. Now, it's a quantum fluid based on this Bohmian concept of quantum potential theory. So it's almost like he's invoking the ether idea, that there's this quantum fluid independent of what we consider to be matter, energy, space, and time that pervades the universe. And that this quantum fluid possibly may be composed of gravitons. Say, what are gravitons? They're hypothetical, massless particles that mediate the force of gravity. But they're particles we have no hope of ever discovering. We may discover gravity waves. We're never going to be able to discover gravitons. Say, why can you be so confident? Well, at a minimum, you're going to need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long just to look at the physics that might possibly give way to gravitons. And as Alan Guth joked many years ago, that's not going to be funded until the Democrats control all branches of the government. So, yes.
Are those gravitons related to WIMPs? I was just reading about WIMPs yesterday in the Wall Street Journal and how they have to do with dark matter. And WIMP is an acronym that I suppose you know what it is.
Yeah, it means weakly interacting massive particle.
Right. No, okay. And they're trying to find those and are having a lot of trouble finding those. Actually,
right.
WIMPs.
Yeah, and WIMPs are thought to be the particles that comprise what we call exotic dark matter. Okay, we got, you've got the matter that you can see, made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. That makes up about 0.25% of all the stuff in the universe. Only 0.25%.
They said 4%. The visible universe was 4%.
Okay, we got something called ordinary dark matter. Ordinary dark matter is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, but is so dispersed that we can't see any light coming from it. It's dark. The only way we can detect it is by its gravitational influence. And then there's what we call exotic dark matter, which makes up about 23% of all the stuff of the universe, and that's made up of maybe WIMPs, people propose machos. But WIMPs is the... you say, what's a macho? Let's see if I can think of the acronym. Massive. I forget what the A refers to. Anyway, macho.
I assume the machos will defeat the WIMPs.
Well, I'll tell you how marketing savvy theoretical physicists are. They decided to trademark WIMP because they didn't want anybody manufacturing a refrigerator and calling it a WIMP. But they decided not to trademark macho. I think it would have made a lot more sense if they trademarked macho and let WIMPs go, but that's the way it goes. Yes?
How do you spell this Bohemian bonehead guy?
Oh. Yeah, Baum. His name is B-O-H-M.
B-O-H-M.
David Bohm.
Bohm?
It's pronounced Bohm. David Bohm. Okay, and he was at Princeton the same time Albert Einstein was, and Albert Einstein, if you know, wasn't too happy with Bohr's idea of quantum mechanics, And I'm not happy with it either. Bohr is another one who has this Hindu influence where he says that our powers of observation actually affect causality at the quantum level. And Bohm, to his credit, says, I don't think so. Einstein said, I don't think so. But then Bohm came up with a new idea, basically taking a different Eastern mystical philosophical interpretation to come up with these Bohm trajectories. So, but yeah, I mean, basically he's changing the definition of space, time, and causality. And this is what Bohm actually says about his physics in terms of its religious implications. He says, by understanding Eastern mysticism, physicists can free their minds, at least briefly, from the self-created prison of imposing discrete categories on experience. So you can understand the philosophy.
Oh, man.
This idea that,
right,
yeah, that there's these discrete entities that we can actually define. He says that's nonsense. So by understanding Eastern mysticism, we can free our minds from the self-created prison of imposing discrete categories on experience in order to attain an instant of scientific creation. So he's basically saying we create ourselves, the universe creates itself. This is what Stephen Hawking had to say about Bohm's ideas about the universe. This is a direct quote. I think it is absolute rubbish. Okay. If you haven't heard the term rubbish, that's a British term for garbage. Okay. I think it is absolute rubbish. The universe of Eastern mysticism is an illusion. A physicist who attempts to link it with his own work has abandoned physics. And that quote is taken out of John Boslow's book, Stephen Hawking's Universe, published by William Morrow. If you want the exact citation, I can give you the page number. Yes.
Two things. One, discrete entities. I believe a more common translation of that would be everything's mind. Everything is illusion. So you as a discrete entity, a dog is a discrete entity, a tree, so on. That's all illusion.
Well, Bohm is actually explicit about that. He refers to the holographic universe. So that's kind of where we're at.
So this sounds like it boils down to they start with a philosophical presupposition and assume it's true with no evidence and then proceed from there.
Well, not only that, they claim to prove it. So this is the circuit of reasoning. They start with these ideas, develop all this mathematics that most lay people can't follow, then claim we've proven our premise. And no, it's simply circuit reason. They end it at exactly where they start.
Isn't that what evolution is?
Well, there are other people who do that too. Yeah, your point.
I was just amused by even in that paper he says excluding experience, like everything we've known and proven and studied and actually have established laws on and know that it's firm and hasn't changed.
Yeah,
he's saying throw those out for the
theoretical. Yeah. It's basically saying you cannot trust what you experience.
Therefore, you can't trust what he's experienced in his
theory. Well, if you can't trust what you experience, you don't have any science.
Right.
Yeah, science doesn't exist anymore. This is why Stephen Hawking made that extreme and strong statement. He says, this is nonsense. It's okay, there's a question over here that I missed. Yes.
Yeah, has there been any response from the scientific community about these claims this week?
I've seen nothing on the web. I look for it to see if the scientific community has responded. I think the reason why you don't see a response, at least I've not been able to find it in published form. I can find the preprint. And the claim is this has been published in Physics Letters B, but hey, I went into Physics Letters B, and it's not there yet. Now, maybe it's been accepted for publication. That's a possibility. And I did read a couple of physicists who say, this paper may never make it into the peer-reviewed literature. So, and I think they got a point because, as I pointed out here, the premise with which it starts is what they wind up actually concluding. So it's simply a circular argument. And in most journals, that would not be accepted.
It's all silliness.
Yeah, John.
I was just thinking that physics letter B sounds like it'd be in the same category as B movies.
Actually, I don't want to denigrate that journal. It's a very good journal. People of outstanding abilities published there. And there's also a need within the scientific community, I would agree, for this kind of speculation. Because what these physicists wind up doing is developing mathematical approaches and techniques that wind up having applications in other areas. And therefore, there needs to be a place where we kind of let people, you know, let's just take the constraints off, let's speculate, see what kind of mathematics you come up with, and maybe this is going to have applications, and who knows? Maybe what you're writing about one day will be testable.
So it's just outside the box, anyway.
Yeah, it's outside the box, and there needs to be a place for that. It's important, however, that lay people who access that journal recognize the purpose of the journal. By the way, it's important that you do that with every journal. For example, the journal of the quarterly journal of the Royal Astronomical Society is a journal reserved for philosophical commentary on astronomical discoveries. And so it's important for people to realize that's what's going on in that journal. A couple of us submitted a paper to that journal, and it was interesting their response. You guys are Christians. And so it'd be okay if we were Hindus or Buddhists or atheists, but because we're Christians, they suggested we publish elsewhere, which is what we did. We published it in a German journal, and they said, hey, there's so few Christians here, we're not bothered by this. So, yes.
Isn't the existence of singularity fairly well verified by cosmic background radiation? So what's the point of the paper?
Well, the singularity is well verified by our observations. By the way, these gentlemen admit that. They say, you know, if we just look at what we observe, we do see an expanding universe, and the universe traces back to where it's really, really tiny. But we have no direct evidence that it goes all the way back to a singularity. And I would agree with that, because we can only trace the universe back to 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. And what they're saying is, between zero and that, maybe there's exotic physics we haven't discovered yet. And so they're speculating about some exotic physics. I mean, it's a lot, it's very similar to the multiverse speculations. We can only observe our universe, but we're free to speculate that maybe there are universes beyond ours. And one of the ways that people have tried to refute the Christian interpretation of the universe is to say there's an infinite number of universes, all different, and our universe has its characteristics by pure chance, not because of God's design. But like this paper, it's inconsistent with our experience. And that's why I made that quote from David Baum, where he basically says, don't trust your experience. Well, with respect to the multiverse, we can choose to examine the universe at all different size scales. The entire universe we're able to observe through our telescopes, the supercluster of galaxies in which our cluster of galaxies is embedded, our cluster of galaxies, our galaxy, our star, our solar system, our planet Earth, the surface of the Earth, the interior of the Earth, all the way down to the subatomic particle level. On all those size scales, we see overwhelming evidence for design. And that overwhelming evidence for design increases as we learn more and more about all those size scales. And therefore, it's simply inconsistent for physicists to say, well, in that arena where we have no measurements and no possibility of making measurements, something happens there that eliminates all of the stuff that we can see. Well, I think they would have a case if we only saw the design at some size levels, but the majority of size levels saw none. But the fact that we see it everywhere tells us that simply going up one more level isn't going to help. And the history of science verifies that. Go back 100 years, we didn't even know the full extent of our galaxy. And we didn't even know there were galaxies beyond our own galaxy. Well, once we discovered there were galaxies beyond our galaxy, we saw a new level of design we hadn't seen before. Every time we've been able to push the size scale up or down to, say, the subatomic particle level, it's opened up another arena where we see design where we've never seen it before. So in that sense, the burden of proof is upon the atheist to say, in that area where we see nothing, it's going to overturn everything. Or actually, I could put it another way. If you're going to appeal to the multiverse to get rid of divine design, guess what? It also gets rid of all your design. Because if there's an infinite number of universes where all the characteristics are different, then I'd be free to speculate that there's going to be all kinds of cellulose throughout those infinite number of universes. And all those random pieces of cellulose, there's going to be random markings, which will be identical to everything you see on this paper. Therefore, this gentleman from Egypt and this gentleman from Lethbridge did not write the paper. It came from the multiverse. And so you're simply pointing out that people are being philosophically inconsistent. And so likewise, I think this is in the same category, because I will bet that these two physicists do trust their experience in terms of sitting down for their evening meal or reading the scientific literature. They're not claiming that the articles they're reading are all illusions. And so they're simply being philosophically inconsistent. Yes?
Along that same line, every creature that we know of uses experience to exist and to go through its life. From the lowliest microbe to the elephant, the bird, every fish, every human, everything that we know of uses experience to exist and to move through time in its life. And as you pointed out, including these two physicists.
Well, I guess you haven't seen the movie The Matrix then. So that is one commentary. It says, looks like these two physicists are still in the Matrix, so we'll see. There's a hand over here, yes.
You know, even if all of this proved to be true, they still would have to deal with the fine-tuning argument. They still would have to figure out how all this stuff came about so that life could exist. So I don't see how it would really hurt the Christian faith if this all even wound up to be true somehow.
Yeah, well, another thing that concerns me about this paper, and I actually watched, he was interviewed by a TV network that came out of Washington, D.C. It was either CCN or something like that. They interviewed Saurya Das. And what Saurya Das claimed, and I saw this in a couple of the web articles, is that they've applied quantum mechanical corrections to standard cosmology. They're really not corrections. That was an overstatement on his part. They're quantum mechanical speculations based on Bohm's ideas about quantum mechanics. But what they claimed was that one correction actually explains a radiation field. And the radiation field stops the universe from having a singularity. So what they're really claiming is that this quantum correction builds up a radiation field that we can't see unless the universe is so extremely young, that when the universe is less than 10 to the minus 35 seconds old, that's where the radiation field has a strong enough influence, it stops the universe from actually having a singularity. But it kind of reminds me of a model proposed back in the 1920s, where they basically said that the universe was static for infinite time and then suddenly began to expand. And so they didn't say that explicitly, but the idea that they invoke this, quantum mechanical correction that generates this radiation field, and that's what stops the expansion from going all the way down to zero, if you reverse it back in time. Yes?
Hasn't anyone questioned him? And you say, well, if you're discounting all experience, therefore you have to discount yours.
Well,
and therefore your theory is of no effect, because that's the result of your experience.
Yes.
Him?
He doesn't say that in the paper. I'm saying that's the heart of Bohm's quantum mechanical formulation.
Yeah.
And they do say in the beginning of the paper that they're using these Bohmian quantum potentials, but they mention nothing about what these Bohmian quantum potentials are. In the interviews that they had, they also don't mention that. In fact, the interview doesn't mention Bohmian quantum potentials at all. But that is the core of what's behind the paper. Without that, the paper does not come up with the results that it claims.
But all ideas come from experience.
Right. But I mean, again, basically what they're claiming in the interviews, we come up with these quantum mechanical corrections that give a completely different picture of the history of the universe. but they're also making the point that they did the math in such a way that it's identical to the Big Bang model everywhere we can see and measure it. It's only in this era before 10 to the minus 35 seconds where things are different. So where we can test it, it's identical, which is why I said my Facebook page that I searched through the paper for some aspect of their model that would distinguish it from standard Big Bang cosmology. I could find nothing. There's nothing that would give a different prediction than Big Bang cosmology that we can observe or test. So the expansion of the universe history is identical to the Big Bang from the present era all the way back to where our measurements stop. Yes.
What would these guys say about the space-time theorems of general relativity, which are pretty unequivocal that there was a beginning?
What they would say is those theorems depend on the way we've been traditionally treating geodesics. If you're going to accept the geodesic concept of cosmology, yes, then we have a Big Bang singularity and the space-time theorems are true. But what they say at the outset is we throw out those geodesics on which our physics is based and which the space-time theorems depend. We throw those out and replace them with these Bohmian quantum potentials and we quote correct. Now, as I said, I think that's a mistake. They're not really correcting, they're replacing. It's a total replacement. It's not just a correction.
Right.
And they do admit that they said a lot of people think we've come up with a quantum gravity theory. We have not. We have done what we think would be the beginning of an approach to a quantum gravity theory. So I do appreciate that on TV they backed up and said, oh, no, no, we're not claiming we've solved the quantum gravity thing. We've not. But we've come up with a new way of, quote, correcting standard cosmology.
Well, I'd hate to butt heads with Penrose and Vilenkin and Booth and those guys.
Well, I think they would all admit if you're going to throw out the geodesics and replace them with these quantum Bohmian trajectories, yeah, then there would be no. But the problem is the Bohmian trajectories assume at the outset that singularities are impossible. So if you begin with that assumption that singularities are impossible, then of course you're going to come up with a result the universe has no singularity. So that's the circular reasoning behind all this. Okay, if there are no more questions, I'm going to jump into the rest of our lesson.
I got one.
All right.
Battling Facebook. On my Facebook, I've been battling people. Because NASA's been making these great claims that they have found other Earths, you know, in our solar system. And of course, then when I go and look at the specifications of the star, I look at the specifications of the planet, it's nothing like ours. Well, why was NASA defining inhabitable zone so broadly that people, when they see that, they think, of course, they're thinking of advanced life. You know, and I have to go back and show the specifications, show the star's too old. You know, the planet exoticity is like a big oval, which means, you know, you're going to have water for spring and fall for a couple of weeks, maybe. You know, why would they define inhabitable as such a broad term? And what's behind it? It makes no sense to me.
Well, I've spoken at NASA facilities a few times, and the bottom line answer to your question is funding. Okay.
The bottom line to all government answers.
In other words, if we have this extremely broad definition of habitability, then maybe we can get the public to support our quest to find habitable planets. In fact, there's actually a catalog online. You can Google this, Habitable Planet Catalog, and it shows about 100 planets that they have found that are, quote, habitable. But if you actually look at the definition of habitability, it's a planet that at least for a brief period of time might have liquid water on some part of the planet. Now, it's not even defined as the surface of the planet. It could be the interior of the planet. So for that example, you've got Europa, which would technically be a habitable planet because there's a possibility that there's liquid water below the surface of Europa. Mars would be classified as a habitable planet. Even Venus would be classified as a habitable planet. So, given that very broad definition, and by the way, you'll see an article I've written on the website, on our reasons.org website on habitability. All the focus in the scientific literature is on what's called the water habitable zone. It's the broadest of all the habitable zones. But another habitable zone that's been getting quite a bit of attention is called the ultraviolet habitable zone. For certain chemical reactions to take place that would be critical for the building of life, you need ultraviolet radiation. So if there's no ultraviolet radiation, then you're not going to get life. But if you got too much ultraviolet radiation, as a few suntan folks here can testify, that's not good either. And so you need to be on a planet where you're getting just the right amount of ultraviolet radiation from the sun. Here's the problem. For most stars, the water habitable zone does not overlap the ultraviolet habitable zone. It does for our star, but for most stars, they're like this. And unless they overlap, you're not going to get life. Well, how many habitable zones do we know about? 8 different habitable zones. And they all have different spots. And for light to be possible, all 8 have to line up. How many planets do we know of where they all line up? 1. We've yet to find any planet in our solar system or outside our solar system where they overlap. Yes?
A friend of mine has an ultraviolet water purifier we take on our hikes. So it sterilizes the water in 1 minute you stir it up.
Yeah, as long as the ultraviolet radiation is strong enough, that will kill all the life in it. So probably a good idea not to stare too long at it, though, because it'll mess up your eyes as well. Of course, you're wearing glasses. You'll be fine. So, yes?
On the definition of life, there was, I think it was Popular Science, said something about a microbe that could, like, literally take electricity from its environment instead of metabolizing it. Is that being used in those?
Well, yeah, I saw that one. There's actually some speculation that maybe we could bioengineer bacteria so they generate electricity from sunlight. So, you know, rather than having these solar cells on your roof, you have a big bacterial bath on your roof. So, of course, you got to feed it all the time, so that would be a problem. But yeah, in fact, on my Twitter account, I just came up with a new announcement that they've come up with 3 different definitions of life. There's the Haldane definition, the Darwinian definition, trying to think of the 3rd definition. But what it reveals is how difficult it is to define what life really is. Do we define it by metabolism? Do we define it by its ability to reproduce? Do we define it by its ability to manage information? Those are the 3 definitions that were thrown out. But there's over a dozen different definitions of life. And with all this research, biologists have yet to come up with an agreed-upon definition of what's alive and what's not. So, for example, there's a big debate. Are viruses alive or are they not alive? We don't know. Yes? I got the question. Mars at one time was warm and wet, but it was warm and wet for only a brief window of time. And it's because you don't have the plate tectonic activity that Earth has. And so if you got warm, wet conditions, given how far away it is from the sun, that water and carbon dioxide basically mix together to make carbonates, and that transforms the planet quickly into a dry, cold state. Now, that doesn't eliminate the possibility of life. You could say during that narrow time window when it was warm and wet, maybe bacteria were there. However, Mars suffers from the same ultraviolet oxygen paradox that Earth does. One reason why we know life did not originate on planet Earth through a naturalistic process is that if you've got ultraviolet radiation streaming in from the sun unimpeded, that stops the biochemistry you need for the origin of life. On the other hand, if you have oxygen that blocks out that ultraviolet radiation, which is what we have on planet Earth today, because of the amount of oxygen in our atmosphere, we have ozone in the stratosphere, and the ozone shields us from the deadly ultraviolet radiation coming out of the sun. So we get a little bit of ultraviolet radiation, the good kind, the long wavelength kind, but we don't get zapped by the short wavelength kind that the sun is pumping out. However, if you have oxygen in the early Earth's environment, that stops prebiotic chemistry. So if you've got oxygen, you can't have the origin of life. If you don't have oxygen, you also can't have the origin of life. And so either way, the origin of life is ruled out. That's true. I'm talking about the origin of life. Okay. And there's a paper published in Astrobiology with this title. Extremophiles are irrelevant to the origin of life. Yes, you can get life surviving under acidic conditions, basic conditions, low temperature, high temperature. We have life forms like that here on Earth. In Antarctica, in the ice, you've got bacteria. But they can't originate under those conditions. And also, what makes possible extremophilic life here on planet Earth is the abundance of what we call mesophilic life, life that exists under optimal conditions. So because of the abundance of that life, it produces resources that allow for the support of the extremophiles. Anyway, that was the basis of the paper, saying yes, extremophiles can exist, but they're irrelevant to the origin of life because they're much more challenging to originate than mesophilic life. Because extremophilic life has to have even more complex biochemistry to repair the damage that they incur from the extreme conditions. So, for example, you've got Bacillus subtilis. That's a bacterium that can exist under a high radiation environment. But the metabolic rate of those bacteria is like a million times slower than photosynthetic life. And basically what that bacterium is doing is it taking the small amount of energy it's able to pull out of the environment and using almost all of that energy to repair damage. But these are bacteria that can exist under high radiation environments. But because of how much energy is being put into the repair mechanisms, their ability to adapt and evolve is extremely limited. So, and then in terms of originating, then it's simply ruled out. But yeah, Mars suffers from the same ultraviolet oxygen paradox that Earth does. But yeah, there was a time when NASA was saying the origin of life happened on Mars, and a meteor struck Mars and transported that Earth to life, to Earth, where conditions were more favorable. That explains the abundance of life on Earth. And incidentally, at reasons to believe, we've been on record as saying the opposite is bound to be the case. Earth is so prolific with life that we're going to find a fair abundance of the remains of Earth life on Mars. Because meteors have been hitting the Earth and causing Earth soil to be exported throughout the solar system. In fact, I would argue you're going to find the remains of life on every solar system body. However, it'll be most abundant on the Moon. In fact, friends of mine have actually calculated how much Earth soil you're going to find on Mars and how much Earth soil you're going to find on the Moon. When it comes to Mars, it's 200 kilograms for every 100 square kilometers. So it's going to be a very thin layer, which probably explains why NASA hasn't found it yet. It's just so thinly distributed. But when you go to the Moon, you're looking at 20,000 kilometers per 100 square, or 20,000 kilograms per 100 square kilometers. That's such a large abundance that it should not be difficult for us to go back to the Moon and find the fossils of Earth's first life. I say the fossils of Earth's first life because that 20,000 kilograms, almost all of it was transported when the Earth was between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years old. And we have none of those fossils surviving on the Earth today. Our geology has destroyed them all. All we got are isotope signatures. But we can go to the Moon and we will find the pristine fossils of Earth's first life. By the way, I'm excited about that because atheists and Christians make radically different predictions on what those first life forms should look like. We can go to the Moon and see who got it right. And I actually got to speak at NASA Houston and encourage them, you know, for a lot less money than going to Mars, you can go to the Moon. And moreover, you're not going to just make the atheists happy, you're going to make everybody happy. Because last time I checked, the American taxpayer had two categories, those that believe in God and those that don't believe in God. And both of them have a vested interest in going to the moon to see who got it right. Everybody's going to want to support this. Moreover, we know we can go to the moon, even with people, and bring them back without them dying. Whereas we have no assurance we can do that on Mars. Yes?
You how thinly dispersed are those fossils on the moon? Would it be difficult to find them?
Well, when the astronauts went to the moon during the 70s, their goal was to find pristine lunar rocks. And what I was suggesting when I spoke at NASA Houston, it'd be good for us to go back with a different objective. Rather than trying to find these pristine lunar rocks, let's find the Earth-transported soil. Now, it's still not going to be easy, because you're only looking at 20,000 kilograms per 100 square kilometers. I mean, you can do the math. You know, that's a pretty big area. You're looking at an area about the size of the Los Angeles Basin, and you've got 20,000 kilograms of stuff. That's a very thin layer. But it's going to be a whole lot easier to recover that than from Mars. The other advantage of going to the moon, we know the moon has had way less geological activity than Mars. I mean, there hasn't been any volcanic activity over billions of years. It's gotten a few crater hits, has no plate tectonics. There's no sandstorms. The only atmosphere it's got is a thin layer of argon. It isn't going to do much. And moreover, our calculations show, not mine, but some friends of mine, actually calculated the velocity with which most of this Earth-transported soil landed on the moon. And unlike Mars, the answer is almost all of it landed with low-velocity collisions, which means that there won't be a lot of impact heat when they hit the moon, which means that the fossils are very likely undisturbed, which is why I said we got a good chance of finding the pristine fossils of Earth's first light. On Mars, there's no guarantee that they're going to be undamaged. And moreover, you're looking at a much thinner layer than you are here on Earth. But another thing you've got to watch out for, we've been to the moon, we've been to Mars, and yeah, they try to clean the spacecraft before they go, but my NASA friends tell me we cannot guarantee that we've not infected Mars and Moon with the spaceships we've already sent there. So again, the challenge is difficult. Okay, how about if we spend some time on our lesson? Hello. You know, this is important. I'm sure this is going to come up for you. I want you to be ready. And by the way, I am going to write an article and put it up on our website. And my colleague Jeff Swearink, another astrophysicist at Reason to Believe, has already done a podcast on this, where he basically makes the point, don't get disturbed about these tiny areas of ignorance that we can never push back. And, you know, you can say, well, can't we just wait until we can get back to a quadrillionth of a quadrillionth of a quadrillionth of a second? It's not going to happen. We don't have the technology. Moreover, there isn't even foreseeable technology that allow us to probe that early in the history of the universe. What we do have is technology that will give us more details on what happened at 10 to the minus 35 seconds. And it's possible that that might be able to discount the claims of this paper. But as the authors point out, we haven't developed our model to that degree. So, until they do. But yeah, we actually do have some good possibilities of discovering, for example, what kind of inflation took place in early history of the universe and what were the gravity waves like. And that possibly could reflect on the claims of this paper. Possibly, because I couldn't find anything definitive that I could say, hey, this is something we could conceivably test. So, we'll see. Okay. Proverbs 8. And I really want to finish this up. And by the way, I also want to take you into Proverbs 30. It's another passage of Scripture where it talks about some amazing aspects of God's creation. So we'll be looking at that next before we jump into the book of Ecclesiastes. Almost half the book of Ecclesiastes is creation theology, so that's going to be fun. But as I've mentioned before, Romans 8 is one of three texts that parallels the account of the six creation days in Genesis 1. And as I mentioned last week, one thing you get from Proverbs 8 is just how ancient the universe and the earth in its life is. And basically you've got the second person of the Trinity. And that's what you see here too. This is a great text for Jews and Muslims. Both of them believe that the book of Psalms and Proverbs is the inspired word of God. As you engage these folks, they are suspicious about certain parts of the Old Testament, but every Jew and Muslim, who is a serious Jew and Muslim, acknowledges the books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, and Proverbs and Psalms are indeed inspired by the God that created everything. So this is a text you can take them to. But notice this text is quite explicit about the doctrine of the Trinity. And so just like Genesis 1 speaks about the Trinity, this one speaks about the Trinity as well. Just the opening passage here, you see in verse 22, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began." So here's this individual who's contrasting himself with God the Father. And like God the Father, he's claiming to be an eternal being. And he's claiming to be the one that actually created everything. You know, that's standard Christian doctrine, that God the Father commanded, the Son was the one that actually created, and the Spirit is the one that actually gave it life or being. All three members of the Trinity are involved in the creation. Yes? Okay, where we're eventually going to go, if you keep attending the class, we're going to get to Isaiah. That's going to come right after Ecclesiastes. And Isaiah is the text that's most extensive and explicit about the doctrine of the Trinity. It was interesting. Ken Samples and I were doing a phone debate with some Jewish scholars. And we took them to, they said, you know, they thought for sure we're going to be arguing for the Trinity from the New Testament. I says, no. The most extensive passage is Isaiah 40 through 48. And what you see throughout that text is repeatedly Isaiah talks about three specific persons that are part of the Godhead, but you also see repeated statements that they are one. So it talks about the singularity of God and the plurality of God. You know, the doctrine of the Trinity, God is one essence and three persons. And Isaiah is really where you want to go for that. But yeah, this particular text doesn't really speak about the oneness of the triune God. It's emphasizing the two-ness, comparing God the Father with God the Son. Right there in the beginning, he's making a claim that he is from eternity. Then as you follow through, "When there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there are no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills I was given birth." And we taught last week what it meant about being given birth. He was the initiator of creation. A good parallel text is Colossians 1, verses 15 and 16, where it refers to God the Son as the firstborn of all creation. And so he's the initiator of creation. He's also the first one to rise bodily from the dead with a perfected body. And so this is, again, picking up that theme. But the very fact is it begins, he was an eternal being. So that right away tells you that he is not a created being. But it also is making the point that he was active, he was a participant in creating the earth, the universe, the mountains, the oceans. He says, "I was there, and I was beside God the Father. I was a handiwork at his side, and I was the one that did this in partnership with God the Father." But notice as you go through this text, it's telling us what God did, the fields, the mountains, and it's all pointing towards humanity. When he gave the sea its boundary, that the waters would not overstep his command, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth, "Then I was a craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world, and delighting in mankind." So it's making the same theme you see in Psalm 104, that everything that God did with the universe, the earth, and his long history of life is all for the purpose of serving human beings and equipping us human beings to fulfill our purpose here on earth. And he rejoices and delights in mankind. Now, I think that's significant because a lot of people will think, hey, you know, God created everything so he can be here, but does he really love and care for me? This is saying no. He delights in mankind. He did all this for us. Surely he must love us if he's willing to go to the trouble of creating for 13.8 billion years, crafting the earth for 4.5 billion years, packing the earth with life for 3.8 billion years, and how literally every life form performs a service and the meeting the needs of humanity. I'm coming up with a book on this next year, making the point that if you look at the entire history of life on planet Earth, every species plays a significant role in setting things up for us human beings. That's probably an overstatement. Setting things up for us human beings so that we could have global high technology civilization, kind of what we've been talking about with the Ice Age. Let me just bring that up for you again. Here we go. This is it. How everything is targeting this little time window when we have this ideal climate that is stable for the past 9,000 years. And without the Ice Age cycle, we won't have the resources we need for global civilization and literally the entire geological history of the Earth for 4.5 billion years is leading up to this 2.5 billion year window when we can have an Ice Age cycle. Only the last 800,000 years do you have a 100,000 year Ice Age cycle, and all of it leads up to this one tiny time window where the climate is stable for 9,000 years. Proverbs 8, Psalm 104, the book of Job 37, 38, and 39 is saying God did all this so we can fulfill his purpose, but also makes the point that he is rejoicing in us human beings. He delights in us human beings. A good parallel passage of that is Hebrews 11, 6, which makes the point that anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists and rewards those who earnestly seek him. He wants us to earnestly seek him. And I just wrote a piece for a dictionary on the problem of evil, making the point that people say, hey, if God really exists, why doesn't he appear right here in front of me so I can see him and touch him? Well, God expects us to use our brains to realize, you know, the most important issue to address in our life here on earth is whether or not there's a God. There is no more important question than that. And, you know, surely we should realize that that's an important question and devote some time to that. That's the rationality behind Hebrews 11:6. This is the looming question of mankind. And it's only rational that we give some earnest pursuit to see whether or not there is a God and whether or not it's a God that wants to reward us. But that's the promise of Proverbs 8. And basically what Proverbs 8 says, we know this is true. Look at everything that God has done to prepare earth for human beings. If he's done all that, then how can you doubt that he wants to reward those of us who earnestly pursue and seek him? And he's not hard to find, but you have to look. It's kind of what we do when we hide Easter eggs for our children. If Easter eggs are out there, they're not hard to find, but you know what? You got to get off the couch and go outside and look. Well, the same message is for us. If you want to find God, you actually got to go out there and spend a little bit of effort looking. And incidentally, isn't that the principle of the Sabbath? The principle of the Sabbath, take one day out of your week to focus on the most important issues of life. Yes, you need to be focused on your job, taking care of your family and your children, maintaining your household. That's 6 days of the week, but you need a time out of every week where you focus on the most important issues of life. Whether or not this God exists, and if he does, how can I come into a relationship with him? Because he wants to delight in you right now. This is not just saying he's going to delight with you in the future. He wants to delight in you right now. And I see you're standing up, which means I've run out of time. So where I'm going to ask you to go for next week is Proverbs 30. And a start in verse 18. And you're going to see things like there are three things that are too amazing for me to understand. And that's actually repeated three times in Proverbs 30. And each case is talking about certain wonders in God's creation that are a challenge for us to understand. They're a challenge for us to understand unless we really do believe this God of the Bible is behind it all. But it's talking about, well, you'll see it all. Anyway, that's where we're going to go next. And we're going to jump into Ecclesiastes, which gives us in gory detail the principles of different laws of physics. But don't be afraid. It's basically saying everything's running down, but there's hope. Okay? And that's kind of what Solomon discovered in his life, that the things he thought were going to give him happiness did not. But hey, it's all pointing us to the one thing that doesn't run down and decay. So, okay. Father in heaven, we do want to thank you for the privilege of being alive in the 21st century. Thank you for these challenges that are coming towards our way for belief in God. Lord, we thank you that we have a faith that is testable, that does make predictions. And Lord, something that we can demonstrate to a skeptical world, that this God exists and that the evidence for this God increases with respect to time. So Father, I pray that this disturbance that we see happening all over our media is taken in context, and that your people are equipped to deal with this, and moreover, to really show people the real evidence for your love and your kindness towards each one of us. So as we go our way, Lord, I pray that you make us sensitive to opportunities where we can literally give people good reasons for the hope within us with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. Pray, too, your blessings on this HAMP conference, that the people would come, would be impacted and equipped to become more effective in taking the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups that they come into contact with. In Jesus' name, amen.